people are going to drink if they want to drink. They're gonna do it. They're gonna find the booze. They've done it all through the years. I mean, even when I was in high school, I can remember if they want to. I don't think that's important as an issue right now as really the stiffer sentencing and enforcing these. That's about all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Charlene. Having raised three kids who are in their mid-20s now, and fortunately they weren't hit by drunk drivers, but they've had their accidents, and thank God mine have survived. As somebody said, you can't really empathize, but I sure understand what it means. Next is Carol Stolpe. He testified already? Okay, next is, I have Mr. and Mrs. Brian Bigler. You're not testifying, okay. Stuart Bigler. Let me just, come on up. I just want to make a comment sort of apropos all these issues that we're talking about, that, you know, our Anchorage community occasionally pays attention to this when it's in the headlines, but we still seem to make a lot more fuss over a black bear or a moose that has some kind of a problem than we do over human beings. And I just get sick of over that. Anyway, please go
Mr.
ahead.
Mr. Chairman, before he starts, it's going to be very difficult for this gentleman to talk to us today. And I just got to say that I am absolutely overwhelmed by the pain that's in this room. And I think we share certainly that with the people.
Well, my name is Stuart Bigler. I guess when my son went to the hospital last Saturday afternoon, he was the fifth that they had treated that day. It was 4:30 in the afternoon, just an hour and a half from now. And you listen to and you read about things that went wrong in the system, and you try to accept excuses, and it doesn't sit very well. How does a person who has committed assault able to walk away from it? And I don't know whether assault with a deadly weapon is considered serious in the legal system or not. I think it probably is. But why should that person be able to walk away and drive again if he wants to the same day? It makes no sense to me at all. I think it's ironic that the driver of the other car, because he's in jail, means he's drying out, and the system is saving his life because he's not able to get a drink. If he was loose, he'd probably be drinking today. He would have had liver failure very soon, considering the amount of liquor he was apparently drinking. So that the system is saving his life. And my son's is not.
Thank you, Stuart. I'd like to ask Alan, how is it that a driver who as in this case, obviously violated the traffic laws and hit someone, if not directly on the spot, kill someone, who causes an accident, why is that driver not detained?
Well, it was obvious to the officers who covered the accident that Mr. Bigler would probably die based on what they saw at the scene. They knew that the other driver had been taken to the hospital and that the doctors had taken blood for a medical blood alcohol test. So that the officers at that point did not, they were concerned that if they filed, they arrested him for drunk driving and filed a misdemeanor, that the man could change his plea the next day to that, and they'd never be able to prosecute him for homicide because it would be double jeopardy. They wanted to gather the evidence and have the case ready to go for the district attorney so that when the man was indicted, the four-month rule would start running then instead of at the time of the accident. It would give the police another week or 2 weeks. And in the cases of some accidents, they need a matter of months to complete their investigation by interviewing all of the witnesses and getting taped statements from them. One of the reasons that the district attorney's office in Anchorage has a very high conviction rate on felonies is that they will not take felonies unless everything is tied up, all of the loose ends, and the case is a very high probability conviction. As a result, the man was not arrested on Saturday. When he was rearrested on our warrant Monday or Tuesday, and then brought in the next day and the bail was increased, the district attorney basically made a decision then that if the judge increased the bail, he wouldn't file a homicide because we would have him off the street and he would have a chance to evaluate the case very carefully and decide which the proper charge was to file, negligent homicide or manslaughter or, depending on the facts, second-degree murder. I suspect it'll be manslaughter.
To what extent is alcohol considered an aggravating as against a mitigating factor in sentencing?
Well, since I don't deal with felonies, I'm a little short on mitigators and aggravators. The best of my knowledge, alcohol itself is not a mitigating factor. In a crime where there is a specific criminal intent, like the shooting with intent to kill, alcohol can be considered in reducing the degree of the crime by eliminating that specific intent. It's called diminished capacity. In the case of manslaughter, it is not a specific intent crime. Alcohol does not free a person from liability for that, unless the jury finds that because he was so drunk, they just basically don't want to hang him with it.
Can it be turned the other way?
I can't think of an instance where a court has gone tougher on a person because alcohol was related, except in the case of a chronic drunk driver who's now charged with a hit and run or something else that's not a DWI offense.
Okay. Our law provides that a use of a gun in the commission of a crime is an aggravating factor. Could use of a vehicle in the commission of a crime, of manslaughter, be conceivably viewed as an aggravating factor?
I can see no reason why it couldn't. But again, right now we're dealing with a crime where the presumptive is now 7. We're in a much better position than we were last year, for instance. If you recall, the Court of Appeals in the Lame Bull case said, we disapprove of giving anyone who kills somebody with a car when they're drunk less than a year in the slammer. This is just not acceptable to us or to society. And this is not the first time that the person who killed someone else when he was drunk with a car got no time to serve.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened a number of times, and it's one of the very frustrating things about being on this side in the legal business.
Thank you, Al. Please, Greg.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but our family's been briefed on. Could you have a come forward?
Oh, the mic is not picking you up.
My name is Brian Bigler. I
live at box 686 in Kotzebue. We've been briefed on the presumptive sentencing, which I believe takes effect on the 1st of April. Am I right? We were run through it very rapidly with an attorney. If my facts are right, it's a Class A misdemeanor, or a Class A felony, if the guy has committed manslaughter. And the sentence has to be 6 years. But is that 6 years that he's going to spend in jail, or can he get time off for good behavior? This guy's had, and he's got a rap sheet. I'd, for our own mental well-being or satisfaction, I'd like to know, all of us would like to know, what's this guy up against?
Everybody gets good time. So he's looking at a minimum of 4.5.
4.5 hard years in...
Hard time. Alaska, I understand, has some of the toughest average sentence lengths in the country for felonies. We don't talk about zero to life for a crime. We just put them in for X number of years and they stay there. They don't walk like they do outside in most places.
Okay, one other question. This is a bit off of that. As I mentioned, I'm from Kotzebue. Many times when laws are enacted such as this, the rest of the state is kind of left out. But in Kotzebue, it's not the norm to drive a car. I do not own a car. I own a snow machine. It's licensed to register. That's a local ordinance that we have to register them. Yet people drive on the road. We drive on the road. That's, you know, through lawns and things like that. But will these drunk driving laws apply to snow machines or three-wheelers? It's very common in communities to drive these exclusively.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer. Senator Rohde would have known, but I don't know the answer. I think so, but I'm not really sure. I'm not sure they're licensed.
Well, they're registered. I have a registration.
But not a state. Is it state or local?
It's a state. Mm-hmm.
It is state.
Mm-hmm. Then it's just like my motorcycle registration.
Then it would, I'm sure, would apply, because it does apply to motorcycles.
Yeah, these are only vehicles in Kotzebue that people coming in from the North Pack and Cobra.
I think it does, because it applies to planes.
That's right. It must apply, because last year we made it applicable to planes and boats as well. So if it applies to boats, it certainly would apply to vehicles on the road.
It has to be on the roadway.
Yeah, on the roadway. On the public roadway.
That was another question. Yeah, it's quite common to drive on the sea ice and around town. Okay, one last question. We've heard testimony from a couple of folks here about loved ones, and I'm sure people know of other people who have been killed or maimed by drunk drivers whose cases are still pending. Will these presumptive sentencing laws pertain to people who have been not?
No.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Stuart. All the best. Bruce? Ken Kirk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Kirk. I'm here speaking simply as a concerned citizen, not for any particular group, and I'll shorten up my comments to allow others time to speak also. I am very definitely opposed to raising the drinking age. What this amounts to is punishing a whole group of people, of legal adults, for the perceived or potential transgressions of a few people. A lot of people tend to think of 19 and 20-year-olds as being children. I'd like to remind you that they have full adult rights to vote, to serve in the military, to sign contracts, and full adult responsibilities. The courts, the jails, the liability. They are not children. I would encourage you to ignore on this issue the endorsements of various groups of people. Prime example is the bartenders, who are serving people who are obviously intoxicated in many cases, trying to find a scapegoat in the 19 and 20 year olds. I hate to say that, some of my best friends are bartenders. This is a deprivation of rights being proposed, not so much a right to entertainment and employment, but also to equality before the law, a fundamental principle. So I would encourage you not to pass HB 17 out of committee, and if it is passed on, to recommend that it do not pass. The other thing I would like to say is, well, I'd like to give a little bit of a caution here. It's okay to have an emotional reaction to tragedy. It's very human. But I would encourage everybody, and especially those of you here, to take the time to think things through a little more clearly and not just react from a gut reaction. There is, as Senator Sturgiluski pointed out, a lot of pain in this room, but there's also a lot of, I think is a very human reaction, that's a desire for revenge. It is not the function of government to exact vengeance. It is the function of government when it can, within whatever constraints are applicable, to try to improve the situation somewhat. And I'm not sure that in a situation like this, where what we're really dealing with is a bad attitude among people in general, I'm not sure if it's possible to entirely change that simply by increasing penalties. We have an attitude in this state and throughout the country that says that driving while intoxicated now and then is really no big deal, and perhaps that can be helped out somewhat by stricter penalties. But we also have an attitude that it's sort of a shame and embarrassment to have to be unable to hold one's liquor, to have to ask somebody else to drive one home or call a cab. You might paraphrase it that real men don't have to call a cab. That's something that simply tossing out a quick piece of legislation is not going to solve. So I would urge you to first think of what we can do to help change people's attitudes. Then, if necessary, think of possibly increasing the punishments on those who do succumb to these attitudes. And if and only if there is no other way and the problem is so terribly serious that it's absolutely necessary, then possibly consider raising the drinking age. But I would submit to you that we haven't even taken the step of depriving people of their rights for such crimes as rape and murder. And I would submit that we have not yet gone through the alternatives carefully enough in the matter of drunk driving and implemented what other alternatives we can to really seriously consider that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you. Next we have Barbara Hoffman. Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess we get a twofer.
My name is Barbara Hoffman, and I'm director of the Alaska Council on the Prevention of Alcohol and Drug Abuse. And Howard Skaman, a consultant for the program. I believe that attitudes are changing. People do not feel today as they felt 2 years ago, 5 years ago. I think today an organization like MAD is the conscience not only of the nation, but we now have our own conscience right here in the state of Alaska. There were some things that I just want to share, a couple things that I haven't heard mentioned in relationship to one of your bills, restoring the legal drinking age. I've found through communication with the lower 48 some interesting things, and I think we could all pay attention to that. We can look at restoring the legal drinking age in terms of vandalism, the reduction of vandalism in relationship to schools, reducing overall problems to the schools with an increase in the age. And then there's something else that happens there too. when you've got a 19-year-old legal drinking age, it seems as though the age group of the 19-year-olds will go from 19 down to 14, and it brings it right into our school system. And our young people are drinking, and they are drinking in the schools. And I think we should pay attention to that. The 21-year-old peer group seems to be 20 to 26 or 27. And that's just something I wanted everyone to consider as you're making your decisions. There was teen testimony in the lower 48, and they talked about some obstacles in the way of the teenagers dealing with drinking and driving, and I wanted to share five of those with you. They talked about easy access to alcohol. It is easy to get alcohol. And they suggested as a solution that their state have an ID card that they would have to get maybe at the age of 8 or 12, or, but everyone, and it would be their responsibility or the parents' responsibility to see that that ID was issued. And maybe it wouldn't be so easy, you know, for a young person to go to a liquor store or to a bar. And that was their recommendation. And I think, you know, with the alcohol education project that we have in the schools here in Alaska, here's looking at you, out of the mouths of the young people, we are hearing incredible suggestions that I think we could all listen to and pay attention to. They're talking about, teenagers are saying, outlaw kegs. And, you know, I know here in Anchorage there are the keg parties, and it's very dangerous. I know that
outlaw
they...
Outlaw what?
Kegs.
Oh, oh.
They call them keggers. And you know what the young people are saying? They get their kegs from adults and parents. But they had a solution, and that is to put a number on that keg, and should young people be in trouble with a kegger, a party, where there is serious trouble and the police are called, to take that number and find out who purchased it. Somebody could be responsible then. So, you know, I think young people have a lot of ideas. Interesting. The fifth thing that they mentioned was peer pressure. The fifth thing. Everything else had to do with us adults and our decision-making process and how we could help that situation. Well, there was some of their, you know, I'm really interested in youth in Alaska. I'm really interested in what is going on. I believe in restoring that legal drinking age to 21 to save lives. I'm in support of the other two bills that are here. I believe that availability and consumption has a lot to do with our alcohol-related problems. And I want to give you something.
Thank you. My name is Howard Skaman, 2322 Lord Baranoff. I'm here on behalf today of the Coalition for a Safer Alaska. The chairman, Mr. Obed Nelson, couldn't stay. The material I've passed out for the committee is also available for any of you that want it on the back shelves. The first page is a recap or position paper on a thing that Dr. Kelso referred to. It's called the Public Health Approach to Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. In the public health approach, you not only look at the problem itself and treat the victims, but you look at the environment which creates it and the agent which creates it. In the case of tuberculosis, for example, you treat the person who has the tuberculosis. No pun intended, one of the best ways is to send them to a dry climate and get them out of the environment that they're in. The third thing you do, of course, is look at the agent which creates the problem, the tuberculosis bacilli. We've heard a lot of talk today about cost effectiveness. Probably the most significant cost effective thing we can do to reduce drunk driving is to concentrate on the availability of alcohol in this state. We drink more than anybody else in the United States on a per capita basis. The It's really interesting. I want to compliment you, Senator Fisher, and the committee on looking at this in the overall picture. You're not looking at an individual bill or an individual response to it. You're looking, as Dr. Kelso said, at the overall picture. We are going to continue to have enormous drunk driving problems in this state as long as we continue to have the highest per capita consumption rate in the United States. If we drink more than other people, we're going to have more problems. The public health approach readily recognizes that social aspects are a contributing factor to alcohol abuse and alcoholism. But there's not much we can do about our age. We simply can't get people older overnight. There's not much we can do about our ethnic background. We can't change everybody's races overnight. Our sexual breakups, our economics, those are things that we just simply can't change. The one thing that we can change is our laws. We have absolutely the most permissive alcohol dispensing laws in the United States. There's only one study been done. It's been Dr. Reginald Smart from Toronto, assigned a scale of availability to the various states. And guess which one was number one in availability factors? On the back sheet of this page here, you'll see that we have one liquor license for every 184 people of drinking age in the state of Alaska. That's 4.5 times the number of the national average. We have not increased excise taxes on alcohol since 1961. It's over 22 years that we haven't touched the excise tax. Consequently, alcohol gets cheaper every year. In real dollars, booze in this state costs half as much today as it did 22 years ago. We have one of the lowest drinking ages in the country. Pink sheet number two here gives basically the history of the drinking age. Proposing restoring the drinking age back to 21 is no big new deal. I mean, this is not some Dacronian punishment that we're trying to, but we had a 21-year-old drinking age here for 38 years. The state legislature, in its wisdom, in 1970, lowered that drinking age. At that time, I was the executive director of the National Council on Alcoholism in Alaska, and I was in favor of it. And you know what? I made a mistake. We all made a mistake. It sounded like a great idea. We were the first state in the country to lower our drinking age. Of all of the states which have lowered it, and there were only 24 that made the mistake that we did, 17 or 18 of them have raised it back up again. So we're not proposing something new. In answer to this other gentleman's questions here, people don't all have adult rights at all times in this state. The sexual age of consent is only 13. You get a driver's license at 16. You can drink, you can vote at 18, you can drink at 19. You can't be a member of the Senate until you're 25.
Just made it.
Just made it. 21 for the Alaska State Legislature. You may not carry a badge and gun on a police department in the city of Anchorage until you're 21 years old, nor will the Alaska State Troopers hire you for that job. Age is an absolutely arbitrary, well, there's Obed, come on. Age is an absolutely arbitrary standard that the community establishes. Item here, alcoholism report. Returning the drinking age or establishing 21 as the legal drinking age for all beverages is the number one priority of the President's Commission on Drunk Driving. The National Highway Traffic Safety Association ranked establishment of 21 as the minimum drinking age as first in importance among 21 proposed supplemental criteria for drunk driving problems. The next sheet in there are two recent studies which have just been completed. The first one is a Dittman survey of the state of Alaska, which was finished last week. It was taken on March 17th through 28th. It says that 66% of the people in the state of Alaska want the drinking age returned back to 21. It's really interesting as you get into the demographics by region, age, sex, how long people have lived in Alaska, whether they're married and things like that. The people who vote most strongly are in favor of returning the drinking age. Next sheet, Mark Hellenthal's study for the Anchorage Municipal Health Department. It didn't give all the options there of 18, 19, or 21, and the Hellenthal study is even stronger. It says that 70% of the people want the drinking age returned to 21. Again, demographics, people who are married, people who have lived here over 3 years, by substantially larger margins, 75% of the people want the drinking age returned to 21. The last one here is a really interesting little sheet. I've been asked several times to testify to Close Up, which is the student group down in Juneau where kids come in from all over the state, study the legislature. This particular sheet of paper was prepared without any input from me whatsoever. Every time I testify in front of them, these 17 and 18-year-old kids in their own committee hearings, listen to the facts and decide that they want to restore the drinking age back to 21. Because they're putting themselves in 40-year-old and 30-year-old positions as committee members. They listen to the facts very carefully. Even without any input, just studying the situation, these team members here have come up with, our team is in favor of raising the drinking age from 19 back to 20. We agree unanimously. The only criticism I've heard of this, and I can really understand it, because as I mentioned, in 1970, I was in favor of lowering it, is a philosophical basis. You know, if we're old enough to fight for our country, we're old enough to drink. I believe sincerely that if we feel that way, we ought to propose legislation to lower the drinking age to 17. That's the age at which we can enlist in the military. I don't think anybody in their right mind would suggest that. 21 is not restrictive. It's not a punitive measure. More than anything else, there are two things that are before you in consideration. In Senate Bill 61 and House Bill 6, the administrative revocation of driver's licenses will do more to reduce traffic fatalities and injuries than anything else in that bill. The second most significant thing we can do to save lives in this state is restore the drinking age back to 21. As Mrs. Hoffman pointed out, all the other states have used traffic accidents as the rationale for returning the age back upward. I would recommend to you that you ask your committee to furnish you with these two reports, which are not in your material. These are the Michigan and Maine studies. I understand you have them and can get them to you. These are really the two definitive reports on what it's all about. When the drinking age is lowered, accidents rise enormously. When it's returned again, Michigan went from 21 to 18, 18 to 19, 19 back to 21, and they've tracked it very thoroughly. Traffic accidents, I hate to keep calling them accidents, they aren't. Traffic crashes and injuries and fatalities as a result of alcohol have usually been the basis for the 21-year-old drinking age. But as Mrs. Hoffman pointed out, the real problem in Alaska is not just automobile accidents. It's this filtered down effect that we've got. 19-year-olds buy booze for kids of any age with no compunction whatsoever. Absolutely none. We have alcohol problems in the junior high school level. So I'd urge the committee to consider the facts really, really carefully. And of all the provisions that are in Senate Bill 61 and House Bill 6, in my opinion, from study, the most important of all, if you have to negotiate or bargain things away or not pass all of it, there's some things in there that offend almost everybody. But you'd think that requiring alcohol education would be popular with everyone. There's some people who don't even educate about alcohol. But if there's anything in there that you do get out of this committee this year, the administrative revocation of driver's license is probably the most important. The criticism there is that you're giving power to the police to take a license away. I got a license in my pocket and I didn't get it from the court system. The Department of Motor Vehicles gave me the license. And if I blow a 1-0 or refuse to take a test, the Department of Motor Vehicles should be able to take it away from me. I still have my court rights to go in 7 days and get it back if I want to. But what we know from other states is, once they got it away from you, most people don't file. They know they're guilty. The current system permits people to continue killing while they're waiting for their trials to come. So that's basically my testimony. I'd urge you to consider very, very carefully the administrative revocation and urge you to consider all the facts on 21.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Howard. At this point, I'd like to head back to the front table here. The Discussion at various times has indicated that we're trying to take a broad look at the problems of DWI and deal with the whole problem issue. We have bills before us, but we don't want to let anything go by. The Alaska's Constitution specifies that the correctional system of the state be based on the principle of reformation, so that regardless of what our personal concepts might be, there is that feature that is part of the basic law of Alaska. And we've asked Emily McKenzie of the Alaska Alcohol Treatment Project to discuss the whole area of the different types of alcohol treatment, their effectiveness, what is being done, what could be done. Emily?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The ASAP program is the Alcohol Safety Action Program, and our main job is to be that neutral link between the court and the treatment agents. We don't do any treatment ourselves. We don't provide any direct services. What we do is to monitor the defendant's participation in the court and ensure that the orders of the court are complied with and that defendant actually goes to and completes the treatment that they were sentenced to go to. Most of our cases are post-sentence as a condition of the suspended portion of their sentence. About 94-95% of them are post-sentence. It is in addition to the normal sanctions of jail and fine and license suspension. At the time the defendant comes into our office, we have about a one-hour interview with that defendant to determine the drinker classification. What we're doing is really a sorting of defendants into the proper channels to send them on to an approved treatment agency somewhere in the state or in the lower 48, if that's where they're headed. And it's not an in-depth diagnostic workup. It's simply a sorting tube. We use the Mortimer filter. One of the reasons I have been so happy with, and I think all of us in the field have been happy with using that type of instrument, is that we're dealing not only with what the defendant tells us in a questionnaire and interview, but also with things that the defendant can't control, which is the breathalyzer at the time of their arrest or their prior traffic and criminal record. In almost any instrument you use to try to determine a drinker category or classification, in many cases you're simply dealing with what the defendant himself is telling you. And the Mortimer filtering procedure allows you to look at information that the defendant cannot control. At the time the defendant is in the office, if someone classifies as a non-tolerant drinker, they're going to an alcohol information school, which is simply an educational component. If they classify as a presumptive problem drinker, they're going to further diagnostic workup. And if they classify as a problem drinker, they're going to treatment anywhere from 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months, whatever is appropriate for that individual. The length of time is determined on an individual basis based upon the problem that that particular defendant has. One of the things that I have disagreed with in the programs in some of the other states is they refer to a first offender program, sending all their first offenders simply to education. And it has been my experience that not all first offenders are non-problem drinkers. And I think that what we should be dealing with, if we're going to be sending these people through treatment, is to deal with the level of the problem which they have, rather than class them all in one group as a first offender. And that's what the ASAP program does, and we assign them to treatment agencies, either in Anchorage, wherever they're going, or in the lower 48.
All right, Emily, you get referrals only when the judge specifies treatment, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, what percentage of people convicted of DWI get to you?
In Anchorage, a very high percentage. Since the change in the law in 1978, since alcohol education and treatment is a requirement, we're getting most of the DWI cases come through Anchorage. in the other locations, I can't tell you what the percentage of the cases are. I might say that some of our cases are coming, there are some other places we get referrals from, the prosecutor's office, sometimes from the child custody investigation or other things, but our primary referral source is district court, and most of them are post sentence after their conviction. They're not convicted and they've gone through the system.
You say after they've gone through the judicial system?
The judicial system.
And when they're going into the correctional system? Or not necessarily?
Well, we see people normally after they've served their jail time.
Is there no treatment in jail?
There's
during?
Very little. There are places in the Division of Corrections that have an alcohol counselor. Highland Mountain, for instance, has an alcohol counselor available. There is an alcohol counselor at both 3rd Avenue and 6th Avenue. But you've got to understand that for some of these people, they are only in jail for 72 hours or for 10 days, and it's difficult to initiate and complete, or it's not impossible to initiate and complete any kind of strong treatment program within that period of time. That's the reason most of the people we're seeing are coming after they have served their jail time. And only in the cases of long-term, where people are intended to go and be in jail long enough time to be classified to Highland Mountain, for instance. Things change in the Division of Corrections quickly, and I don't want to presume to speak for how they handle things. I think that Highland Mountain requires 6 months incarceration before you can be sent. In other words, people who have shorter terms are not sent to Highland Mountain. Probably the most important thing you do is to monitor that defendant's participation in the treatment program. Years ago, when people were sent to treatment, the court really had no way of knowing whether they actually went, whether they completed the treatment, and if they stopped going, if they weren't participating at a satisfactory level. The court had no way of finding that out. Now we're getting reports from treatment agencies on a monthly basis, and when a defendant is in non-compliance, this is reported back to the court in the form of an affidavit, and in most cases in April, the court issues a benchmark for their arrest, and they're brought back before the court. Now, at that time, they're going to have to post bail, they're going to have to make another court appearance, and it comes back, again, to the discretion of the judge in how they handle a particular case. Our program is administered by Highway Safety Planning Agency, and you know, the funding comes through the legislature and through the State Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, through Highway Safety and Anchorage's case to the court system. It's a highway safety focus on the DWI question. I think that over the years, what our office has been looking at has not been treatment outcomes, which we would get through the treatment agencies, but rather, when we have a defendant in front of us, we have two clients, the person that's sitting there, but also the person on the highway that has a right to get where he's going without being injured or killed. And our focus is whether, in looking at whether we are doing our purpose in life, is to see if that defendant is coming back through the system. Is he coming back, is the recidivism greater or lesser for coming through the ASAP office? Dr. Kelso looked at the 1978 DWI, and Alaska was a little different from the lower 48 in that in the ASAP studies in the original ASAP projects in the lower 48 that the federal government funded, there seemed to be more of an outcome with non-problem drinkers. That was not true in Alaska. We found that with a non-problem drinker, Dr. Kelso found that with a non-problem drinker, it really didn't make a lot of difference whether they came through an ASAP program. But with the problem drinker, that there was a significant lower rearrest rate after a year from the date of sentencing than those that had not gone through treatment. And one of the things that I think we need to look at in response to sending people to treatment as a part of the overall DWI sanction, that I don't it's that systems approach. The fine, the jail, the life suspension, and the treatment, all of them are rolled up into one and all working together that will make a difference in the future. I think that in putting someone in treatment, one of the first things that's important is for the defendant to accept the responsibility for his own actions. And I think that going to jail and having that fine and having the license suspension is all part of that responsibility. The treatment agencies that we're dealing with, the ones that approved by the State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, are having an opportunity to make an intervention or to intervene with the defendant at a much earlier time than would normally happen. A lot of the people we see don't think they have a problem. They don't feel that there is any reason for them to go to treatment. And we have had people in our office time and time again who say, I paid my fine, I spent my time in jail, I've had my license action. Now, why do I have to be here? You're going to impose on and interfere in my life in the next 6 months. I have the best possible chance to make a difference here. Because we're not talking about people who are on 4th Avenue who have had a long, long, long history where they have lost most of what they had in their life, their home, their car.
Emily, could people like that be dealt with easier if reinstatement of a revoked license be made conditional upon some kind of a process, be it treatment, education, whatever? And if they're not willing to say, okay, this is worth my getting a license back, or I have a problem, whichever way it goes, because I would think that part of the education process could be to get them to realize that they have a problem so that then don't go right out in the road again and kill someone if we just automatically give them a license back after 30 days or 6 months or whatever.
States have used it. There are quite a few states right now that you can't get your license back until you complete the treatment program, until you go through whatever is proven.
I think that too, I don't know to what extent it is, but even for lesser offenses, I think it's in the home context, part of the condition of dealing with the sentence of action is going to be the human process. So you can use it in a variety of ways. There's two things that Emily is in day-to-day contact with the treatment, but one thing that you pointed out is that the state of Alaska has no probation or correction services for misdemeanors. And everybody's aware of the really difference of how to handle when a criminal case comes up. One of the functions of the agency is search, and some of the quasi-probation of the search. And so, you know, it's only being applied in this case to people who are offenders. So I think the ability to manage a caseload after the disposition is also an important aspect of what's going on. And the other element is it's not a, substitute for jail, it's not a substitute for sentence, it's not a divergent program, it doesn't divert anybody from any place else, it's on top of it.
Mr. Chairman, just a question that may not be a fair question because you utilize the resources that are there in terms of people going into programs and so on, but do you see major gaps about the kind of treatment programs out there? Are there certain areas that you working in that field or lack?
I'm doing the statewide coordination, and one thing that I see in treatment agencies, there is often not a good place to put a teenager into residential treatment. We have them. Anchorage has an opportunity to send a defendant to an adolescent-focused treatment agency. But a lot of the areas in the state don't have that opportunity, and it's very difficult for them to find that type of facility available. And from time to time, judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys have mentioned that they would like to have more resources available to them for the defendant who's 16 or 17 years old.
All right, then let me ask you a question. As I mentioned in the beginning, we were discussing with Roger and Dell possibility of having a special facility, minimum security kind of facility, for incarceration of DWI offenders, persons convicted. Would it be feasible to sort of build into that kind of a facility a screening process, an education process, a treatment process, if they're there for 3 days or 30 days or a year, that they would in effect be surrounded by a treatment and rehabilitation environment, so that they be conscious and be exposed to the potentials of change, whether they like it or not.
One of the things we were contacted about the Division of Corrections just 2 weeks ago was something that I had talked about with Highway Safety and we hopefully would be able to do, and that is the possibility of doing some of the screening in the corrections facility. And this is something that we're hoping we can do even now without anything, any new facility being built, but simply starting in our way at this point. The treatment, the difficulty with treatment is that it needs to be longer than the 3 or 10 day sentence. What I would like to see is if we are able to do some of the screening, some of the referral, and set up the mechanism during the shorter period of time and have treatment initiated when you have a longer period of incarceration for the defendant. Simply because now, if we had a non-problem drinker who was just going to be sending to an alcohol information school, by all means, that type of educational program could be well set up within the corrections facility. It's a longer-term treatment that I think will have to go on after the sentence that the defendant is serving 3 days or 7 or 10 days.
Thank you.
No, Mr. Chairman, just one thing. I wonder if we could make a note to have some staff work. There was a very legitimate concern brought up earlier dealing with the bootlegging, and I have seen the Ween Fargo flights, and I think that would be interesting. We passed stiffer law, either was it last session, I believe, that you know, in refinements, if you will, to the whole allowing local autonomy and local option. And I'd kind of like to follow up to see how we're doing, and I think there'd be some major centers that perhaps we have to go to the court system for that, or to the police agency.
That's a very good point. I have asked Susie to look at what's going on with respect to adequacy of statutory requirements also. I'll go back to the audience. Looks like we may make a 4 o'clock target yet. We've lost a number of people.
List of people that Sunday.
Thank you very much. I'll go down the list. I have Helen Philly. I'm sorry you all have to wait so long, those who are testifying, but I really want to make sure that we get as much as we can today.
I'd like to bring up a point that I don't think has been brought up today.
Please, go ahead.
Okay.
Could you state your name for the
I'm Helen Phillip. I'm the wife of a husband who is an alcoholic, who has been through our court system. He has had 3 DWIs in the last 6 months. He's in jail at this time. Let me go to my notes. He was arrested in July on a DWI and received a 3-day sentence and alcohol screening, I believe, at that time. 4 months later, he was arrested in November for DWI. Again, he received a 3-day sentence. I was really quite upset about the sentence. Called the court, the alcohol screening people, city prosecutor, and whoever else would listen. The sentence did get revised to 30 days in jail and outpatient treatment was ordered. He was released December 15th. Made his appointment for outpatient care through Clitheroe Center for January 6th. 2 weeks later, he was arrested again for a DWI and suspended license. This time, he will spend 6 months in jail. 60 days of this time to be used for treatment. I'm still working on getting the treatment for him. He's just about to the end of his jail time. He has not yet received his treatment. I'm working on that this week. This could only be done with his consent also. I have no say in this matter unless I have his consent to do this. Okay, and this morning, I'm not going to go through that. It's been brought up so many times today. I really feel, I mean, we can have more laws, we can have stricter laws, we can have tougher determinants. But as long as we have the type of situation with alcoholics that we've got now, where we are giving them the right to say, I don't want help, and there isn't anything that anybody else can do about it. Me, or, you know, anybody else. I can go to every agency in town and be told, I'm sorry, we can't help you. Does he want help? No, he doesn't. We won't talk to you. Period. Okay. It goes back to the same thing. Who has the right to make this decision? The alcoholic? He doesn't want the help. The victim? He had no say in his death. The family that knows him well and knows there's a problem that could maybe see that there is some help. They don't have any place to go for help. My possible solution to part of this problem and would be maybe opening up the communication gap between the families and the courts, maybe by means of a mediator, that the families that, when I know that he is going to be a danger to himself when he walks out the door and gets in that car, that I had somebody that I could talk to that would maybe talk to the judge and maybe see that we could stop it there. He doesn't want the help at that time, but that doesn't mean that we have to sit back and let him go out and run over somebody. It just is not right. And that's the way it is. It is the way it is. It could be a mediator, it could be a clinic, or it could be an agency. I think in the latest fatality accident last week, the wife had the same problem. She had tried for a year to get help, and it was not available. If she could have gotten help, it may have not have happened. It may have, but it may not have. And if we could save one life by intervening someplace along the way, I think that it probably would be worth it. Because of the overcrowded jail situation that we have, and that's all been brought up already today so many times, maybe these people need to be separated from that program. There's been talk of the pipeline camp. I think that's a good idea. Maybe it should be located where they could be put there. Treatment could be there. Maybe if it's feasible. I don't know if it's feasible. All I know right now is, when there's a problem, when I know that there's a problem and I really can't stop it from happening, then we have a really severe problem. We have a severe alcohol problem in Alaska, period. But we have to have severe answers for it, too, and severe ways of dealing with it. I've been married to him for 25 years, so I know him really well. I know when something is just about to come down. I think I should have the right to be able to tell it to the judge or to somebody that can talk to somebody that would can. And it would like to stop it at that point.
Ellen?
I'd be willing to help with anything that I could.
Well, I really appreciate you coming forth and giving us the other side of the problem that we've been hearing about today. Okay, you know this man, you know him well, you've stuck with him. Do you feel that if there were court-ordered treatment, if there, you know, if somebody could intervene, and instead of everybody saying, well, if he doesn't want it, if he doesn't feel he's ready, we won't bother with him. And as somebody pointed out earlier, Alcoholics Anonymous has this concept that the only person who can be helped...
If the alcoholic wants it, then
that's right. Available. That the only way the person can be helped is if that person recognizes the need, the existence of a problem. Now, you know this man well. Would there be a potential of doing something for him if he does not say, I have a problem?
I think so. I think the treatment would at least, I think it would sink in. After, I do think there should be jail time. I'm not saying no jail time. I'm saying he should go to jail. He should spend that time. We should work with him there. But he is going to get out of jail. I mean, he's not going to stay in jail forever for a third DWI. He is going to get out, and he is going to go back on the street. So he's either going to go back out with some treatment, which may possibly prevent it from happening again, or we're not going to give any treatment, and he's going to go out and interview. It's going to happen again. And I mean, it's not a situation where he's going to stay there forever. Yeah. So we have to look at the outcome.
Is there any way that he could be coerced into it, or enticed into it, or sort of, you know, what external
not sure, means because everybody that I talk to, and every agency that I've talked to before any of these things have happened, before he's been arrested, mm-hmm. have said, I'm sorry, he doesn't want help, we cannot. There is no place to go mm-hmm. to even begin to see if that might be the answer. Mm-hmm.
Dennis, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, just a couple. There is a proceeding in Gotham.
There is, yeah.
An involuntary commitment proceeding.
And
there's evidence in that, and I've got to work it out.
And there's nobody that'll even want to talk about it, believe me.
And but as far as the mediated concept, I think that's a really good idea, except for in DA's office or however.
Right, it would have to be set up, you know, so that they could be screened, because otherwise you would have people going in there to have people put away for no reason. I understand that. It would have to be screened and verified. And
it's a provision within the law now, and admittedly, it's awkward. There's been several attempts over the last 3 or 4 years to clean up the inadequacies of it. That entry into the system is
sure.
The first problem. The second problem is the lack of security for the treatment state. That even the, once you get through the VA, it's where does the person go to, what kind of treatment program. And there has been the funding and the wherewithal to be able to develop a secure facility in order to be able to put the person in that and to maintain the security. Now that may, the chairman, blend in with your concept of a more of a long-term care, low security prison, but we have a fundamental different concept when we look at long-term jail and for DWIs and long-term treatment care, conflicts of staff, or philosophy, building codes, conditions, really
sure, but it's quite but it's easier to get a mentally incompetent person into a situation, out of society and into a place than it is to get an alcoholic off the street.
Mr. Chairman, the basic problem that you know you raise and you're living with is the most successful approach. It's either using AA totally or a combination, and that seems to be what's working, and obviously the idea of earlier intervention into it instead of getting where you've got a mushy brain. But it's contrary to all of the kind of treatment, isn't it, that we're using for alcoholics. Let them reach the level and then they can bring about change. And yet, to know that you're living with a loaded gun or a rocket or whatever you want, it's got to be the most, you know, very horrifying thing. And if there's some way in between...
Well, I definitely think there is. I think if you had a mediator that I could have went and talked to, and I, you know, or
like this last week, we at the city could have went and talked to. We could have talked this out between myself and somebody else and let them know what the problem was. Maybe that person at that time could have taken it to the district attorney's office or to the judge. And she could have looked through this stuff and saw that, yes, this is a real possibility of something exploding, you know. And we will take action,
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if there's any way that, again, that gets into that follow-up and their miscreants. Apparently there's no real follow-up on the sentencing. If there could, and does that take too much to identify certain types based on their record, that there is some hole that goes on longer that could be triggered by certain actions?
You have to address it to Dennis, not to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, through the chair.
The state of the art is there in the HAP program to make decisions about the kind of care that a person might need based on the information coming through. The state of the law didn't, nor the services. But part of the problem with the court system and part of Judge Andrews' pioneering efforts is that she has no right under the law of the treatment or sanctions. Who takes on the challenge in the court order, who gets the delegate. It's not an established kind of sanction to go with. Now there's, on the other hand, the attitude that was just mentioned about the people having to want treatment. It has been an attitude of providers of treatment providers in the field. There's no question about it. More recently, that's been changing, but the ability to respond to it has been held back simply by the overwhelming number of people in need of treatment and the fact that the treatment agencies have to sit there and they have this long waiting list for people to come in and can sit back and say, why should I knock my head against the wall for somebody who doesn't want treatment? At least got a whole bunch of people over here to do. To the very people that need to treatment most and who benefit the most from the survival point of view are the ones who are left slide back through because of the lack of treatment. So right now, in the Anchorage program in particular, there aren't enough treatment slots for all the people who are either in the board or a secure facility for some of these ways to operate. Now, that brings into something else though that may be useful is that there has been proposed legislation through national efforts to get at alcohol aggravated criminal behavior such that the criminal code is adjusted so that notice taken whenever the criminal activities involve alcohol. And after two or three events that are alcohol related, then a different penalty structure comes to play. And then that penalty structure can then start to invoke the alternative treatment.
It's usually a whole series of my situations. Alcohol type thing.
Excuse me. I see Alan leaving. Alan, I want to thank you for your contribution today. It was very helpful, and I trust we can count on more help from you as we go along.
Thank you very much for having me here. Anytime you need any information, just give me a call.
Good. Thank you very much. Please go ahead, Alan.
So when you're sitting back and you watch this alcohol problem grow before it gets to a point that something serious, really serious, is going to happen. It does grow. It's a slow progress. It gets steadily worse and steadily worse. And usually the families are aware of it. I think that we need to have some place to let you know when it's going to level off and when something's going to happen.
And I guess we could use a hotline of some sort for that.
And it's not fair. I know I've heard that people put down the police department today for this, and it's not fair. I mean, I can't expect to call them and say, you know, he just got in his car and took off down the street. Well, I don't know which street he's going to drive, and I don't know where he's going to go. I mean, he's not in any condition to know himself probably where he's going to go. You can't blame those people. I think we have a good police department. I think we have an efficient force, and I think they do the best job available. The problem is before that.
All right. This brings up a point that you had made and somebody else made about safety devices and automobiles. Now, can any state other than California really, I mean, could Alaska conceivably do something in that area, especially with all sort of old cars we have?
Mandatory seatbelt, but you can't even do it. Because they fumble when they get in, you open the door, and they fall out of the bed, so they can't buckle a seatbelt. The car won't run. Just make it so you cannot start the car unless they just go.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
I think theoretically.
Yeah, but right. But if we passed a law like that, the chances are General Motors wouldn't bother sending cars to Alaska because they don't sell enough.
The rest of the states are all restarted. Somewhere along the line, Mr. Fisher, the rest of the states, the people are so unhappy that they're working to the vigilante.
Well, maybe the vehicle is to petition the Congress to act in this area, to provide some kind of a locking devices that
something the driving commission could pursue.
Pardon me?
The driving commission could pursue something like that and represent the state.
That AAA, seat belts, or they'll right be right after that.
No, Mr. Chairman, real seriously, I had to be down in Seattle yesterday, and I rented a car, and it was what do they call it, a Toyota Corolla or something. It's got the gall darnedest thing in it. You cannot get the key out of that, and it took me the longest time to figure it out, because the inside light didn't, unless you push this button down and you do all these spinoki things.
Right.
And I would bet that would frustrate someone that was inebriated so much they couldn't get it out.
It's not getting it out. We've got to have a system against
getting
it in.
No, it's still to get it in.
Right.
If
we
had... It works both ways.
Yeah,
it works both ways. Toyota, of course, both Japanese are good for that. Make it work both ways, because you can't get the key out without pushing the little lever down. Have another lever, you got to push the lever the other way to get it.
Certainly it has to be investigated. I think that the digital ignition devices are things that can be added on. They could be part of dealer preparation and elasticity.
This
is just getting the passive airbags and stuff.
Do you have information on that?
We'll
dig it out.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Helen, thank you so much for your contribution.
Really?
Next, we have Denise Knapp. We've worn some of the people out. F. Brantingham.
Fred Porter.
He did. All right. George Coffin.
My name is George Coffin. I live at 3404 Woodland Park Drive, Anchorage, 99503.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, sir.
And I'm here as a private citizen, a retired police officer, 14 years. And it behooves me, Mr. Chairman, that we can put a man on the moon. But as Rick said before he left, these convictions, we can't get them in a machine. If we can't get them in a machine, why don't we get some people that can get them in the machine? A suggestion would be the arresting officer. If you arrest somebody and you have some evidence, you pick up guns or something, you can put it in ACIC and NCIC in 30 seconds. So the arresting officer, he gets it back. He doesn't wait for the court system to put it in the machine. This is idiotic. This accident the other day could have been prevented. The judge turned him loose. Why? There's no reason in the world for those two people to die the other night up there. And then the fella sitting next to him, the owner of the car, said he was too drunk to drive, but they didn't touch him, and he's the owner of the car. He should be in jail, too. I don't understand the whole court system, which is the reason I retired. You can't beat him, so I got out. We had a chance here a few months ago to change the situation, and we only got rid of two. we missed about 14. Maybe next year we'll get another chance. I don't know. But this needless slaughter has got to stop. My first experience driving from Palmer in 1970, I believe you remember the three cheerleaders from East High?
I remember that.
From my and street.
Five of them. I come along that 30 seconds after it happened. And this is, I hadn't been a police officer just a little over a year and a half, and I sure wasn't prepared for that. The two young ladies in the front seat never got a chance to uncross their legs. They never knew it hit them. And I thought they were just out when I went in there. And this was 13 years ago, and I still see this. And I'm not acclaimed with it in any way. They weren't no members of my family. But a police officer in this day and age is the thankless job. And that's why I got out. You can't beat the machine. These judges turn them loose. I can show you the paper. $500 fine, 30 days in jail, $250 suspended, and three all but 72 hours. And I can name you the judges. And then on the same one underneath, no alcoholic deals for 6 months or 1 year. And then right below it, the same guy, driving while license suspended. 30 days in jail, suspended. $200 fine, suspended. Where will we go? It's going to be up to you to change this and force them that they can't do this. Everybody here today was talking about the defendants. What about the victims? They don't get a chance to say nothing. It's all over for them. Some things you might consider to go on to other areas. As far as an ID, I think that with all the devices and everything we have today, you could do the same thing that I did when I was in the Navy. In the Navy, if you were under 21 years of age, you got an ID card that you couldn't break the plastic, and it had minor stamped right across the front of it. Any place you went, they had a flashlight. They didn't look for the date of birth. If they saw the red letters, out, you couldn't get in. The day you turned 21, you went back to the personnel office, and you got a brand new one with no minor on it. We could do that here. When the child's born now, they get a birth certificate and a Social Security number. It'd be up to the parents to get one of these good state ID cards with minor strapped across the front of it, and when they turn 21, they can go change it themselves. As for the liquor, I don't know. I think Mr. Fisher and I are about the same boat. Little gray on top. I got a little more.
You got that.
A little bit more. But we face the same
more.
Thing.
Yeah.
Well, I lost the rating. We had to wait till we were 21. But I can remember my granddad telling me, you can pass all the laws in the country and in the world. Three things you'll never stop. Drinking, gambling, and sex. Not necessarily in that order. Anytime you tell somebody they can't do something, they're going to do it. We did it. It's just that things have changed now. In our back in our day, I didn't know what a car was. I walked to school. And then I had my kids tell me that if they didn't have a car, they wouldn't go to school. Well, they're still in Welton Tech, and they're walking. But by reducing the way you can control the liquor in Colorado, they have a stamp for a package store, and they have one for a bar. Every bar owner has a stamp. He has 24 hours after he gets his liquor and beer to get his stamp on it. If the alcohol beverage comes through and he's got liquor on the premises that is not stamped, he's closed for 90 days. This way, when they pick the booze up, they know where it come from, whether it came from a package store or if they got it in a bar. You're not allowed to leave a bar.
They take a can of beer?
No, the package when you buy it. The one you get in the store, in the bar, you can't take out. In Colorado,
right.
You can't take anything out of a bar.
Okay. All right, so it's in a package store.
In the package store, they've got to stamp the package.
The six-pack.
The six-pack. There is a number on, and usually if you pick somebody up in the car, every time I stopped anybody, if he had one can of beer, he had the whole thing there. He hadn't just thrown it out yet.
Yeah.
But the number is there. A package store has a different number than a bar. A bar has a different number, and they know where the stuff come from. So this would help as far as Bethel, there's other places. You'd know where the booze was coming from, so somebody'd have to answer to you when the alcohol beverage went in. This would control the liquor, where it's going and who's selling it. You ought to be able to form a national pool for these drunk drivers. An insurance company can tell you within inside of 30 days when you get a speeding ticket and your insurance rate goes up. Now, why can't we do the same thing when Joe Blow comes up here from New York? He goes down and gets a new license for Alaska, and a year later you find out his license was revoked for drunken driving in that state. But the states don't interchange this information. But if you had a central pool, you would know when Joe Blow arrives from New York, he's got a bad record. Usually when you arrest somebody, people are funny. I arrested a fella here, and he had an Alaska license plate. He had a Hawaiian driver's license and one in Massachusetts. So I wrote both places. You ought to see in the letter I got back from Massachusetts. His license had been revoked 5 years prior, two DWIs. So they automatically revoked it here because he lied when he filled out his application. But this is what you're up against. But with a central agency, these drivers coming from another state aren't going to drive. And I'm a firm believer, first offense, take his car in 1 year.
Mr. Chairman?
Carlos?
On that point, I wonder if we could make a note to check whether or not there are any barriers on the privacy rights or record rights and so on that are preventing, say in our state, that our information at least can go to other areas, and if that's a barrier in information coming. I happen to know of a personal case in Juneau where they did in fact get the individual's record from the state of Washington, and they found DWIs and disguised them, even though he's a truck driver that earned $47,000, he's going to get a mandatory sentence because of that earlier arrest down there. And I'm just wondering if you know, what the barrier to the flow of information is, both to us and also to us for sending it.
I didn't have any trouble in Massachusetts or Hawaii. I just stated that I was a police officer in Anchorage, and they sent it back through channels.
Yeah.
Now, maybe I got lucky. I don't know. Because
any problem.
According to what Rick said, that you can't get that. Maybe some states will not give you that information, but I don't think that information should be withheld. When you apply for a driver's license, it's a privilege, and the information that could be derogatory for you to keep it ought to be public. So it is in process.
It's in a process.
But the state of Alaska is not a member of that at this point because of money.
Well, that's something we need to know.
Charlie Smith can address that specifically.
Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't address it.
Yeah. We'll be looking into that specific issue come Tuesday in Juneau. That's on our agenda.
I think also we ought to look at the point of these magistrates we've got here. This magistrate system is... he's not an attorney, he's not a lawyer, the law doesn't mean a thing, it just all depends on how he feels at the time you go in there. I was down there one time, and in my 14 years as a police officer, I have yet to see a judge give anybody 1 day's time for assaulting a police officer.
Well, I got kicked,
I got stomped, I got spit on, and not one did I ever see, and I saved him for 10 years, did I see a judge in here give anybody 1 day for an assault on a police officer. Till one night down there at the magistrate, I had this guy, and he was belligerent. And when I went in there, I was all tore up. But the magistrate stepped up from behind his chair, and when he did, the guy kicked him right in the groin. And he was going to turn him loose. And then he looked at me when he could talk and says, "Why didn't you?" I says, "Hey, the shoe's on the other foot now, isn't it?" And he went to jail. But if he hadn't have done that, he wouldn't have went to jail.
We have
to have something beside a magistrate, Mr. Fisher. Like you said, I used to get down there and get a drunk there, and before I could get my paperweight made up, the guy was back out there trying to get his car.
Well, are you talking about district judges in Anchorage or magistrates?
Magistrates down here where you take them when you get somebody in sixth and C. He's the one that decides if that man goes to jail. And I thought the law said is if you take a drunk, he's supposed to stay 24 hours so he can't get his car. At least he's sober when he does. But they turn him loose in 4 to 6 hours. Sometimes the guy will release him right there on his own recognizance.
Yeah, well.
So I used to beat him to the punch. I didn't pound the car. At least it would take him a while to find it. But these magistrates, you don't. All you have to be is a high school graduate, and some of them can't read and write. I sure thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Carol Starko? We heard. All right. Mr. White Keys?
He's gone.
Gone. We'll be heard from again. George Reed, Helen Reed. Hello, Helen.
A long wait.
My name is George Reed, Post Office Box 19-4-1928-99509.
My name is Helen Reed, Anderson. Well, first of all, I wanted to agree with Judge Andrews about the need for more prevention and education and more intensive alcohol rehabilitation. I believe that there should be a mandatory intensive one-year alcohol rehabilitation after the second or third offense. This 72 hours or 2 weeks or however much, or even 1 month is not enough for a person to completely dry out and become rehabilitated or even begin to think straight. I agree to raise the drinker's age, but not the curfew. And they've all been talking about the drinkers, and I think something should be done about the vehicle and the booze. I think that when a person is drunk and they're picking up drunk, that their car should be taken away immediately and not given back to them until they can have a blood alcohol level of zero. And that if it repeats again, that they should be their car should be taken away completely, no matter who's in their family or who else argues against keeping it. I think that the car should be auctioned and the money used for a rehabilitation program. I believe that the source of the booze all comes, like somebody said something about they don't know where the kids get it or all this. Well, you eventually go back to two or three sources. One is the bar, the other one's packaged liquor, and the other one's wholesale. So those people should be charged additional taxes or fees. And that money should be put used to for prevention and education and rehabilitation. I think that more money should be appropriated for existing programs instead of cutbacks. Also, the driving is not a right. I've heard somebody say that driving was a right, but it's a privilege, and that in order to keep this privilege, that people observe the driving rules. I also agree to revoke the bill that says not to charge the driver for cost of rehabilitation. I think that they should be charged, and that should go towards alcohol rehabilitation and prevention. I was going to suggest that they have a computer printout on each person regarding their drunk driving records when they come before the judge or the magistrate, but it sounds like that may not always be accurate. When an accident happens,
the driver should be retained until his blood alcohol level goes to zero. During that time, if the victim dies, that then they should retain him for a crime.
Mr. Chairman, is drinking established to be a right or a privilege?
I assume it's a privilege. It's certainly something that's withheld from those under 19, at least the privilege of buying it. I guess there's
then,
nothing to keep a
15. Then if it is determined to be a privilege, the direct cost and all indirect costs should be charged back to that industry. I would like to get out here, leave here today and go to Hawaii, but the cost prevents me, and through different agencies, and this seems to be a safety problem, what we're talking about. And the safety in the airlines industry and the automobile industry is passed back to the consumer. So if this was addressed as purely a safety matter, and it would take care of a lot of other problems. If that industry was charged for all of cost, then you would see it would be cheaper to go to Hawaii than it would to be able to drink. And the industry would regulate a lot of its own problems. And I think that's the main issue right there, is you could get the industry to regulate itself by not picking up these costs and or charging them directly back to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not the airlines doesn't subsidize accidents. It pays its cost, and through that you pay higher tickets. They deregulated oil. The oil price has gone down. Your tickets, your gas is cheaper because they deregulated. So all cost, enforcement, court, all cost, indirect cost, be charged back to that industry. You would solve a lot of problems right there. And